Writer Victor Pereira was born in Guatemala. From the time he was 12 years old, he lived and was educated on the East Coast of the United States. Like many who leave their homes, he learned to look back and to think about his homeland both from within and from without. We have the fruit of that thinking in the form of a completed trilogy, the last book of which is called Unfinished Conquest, The Guatemalan Tragedy. Victor Pereira is with us on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Please join us as we talk about Guatemala from one man and one writer's point of view. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. It's good to be here.
I want to talk about this book, about Unfinished Conquest, and I want to get there by laying foundations. There, you talk about three conquests of Guatemala, mm-hmm. the latest of which started sometime between the 50s and the 70s. But I think it's important to start with that first one, when, mm-hmm. if we can, when Cortez sent mm-hmm. Alvarado north to bring peace to the people.
Well, this is not my idea. I borrowed it because it fit so well what I was experiencing and seeing. The idea of the three conquests, I think we should attribute George Lovell, among other historian geographers, Canadian, have evolved this idea, and it's still in a process of evolution, because maybe there will be a fourth cycle of conquest. Mm. But the first one is the one that historians have treated with most, and it's the one that is shared with other parts of the Americas. It's the arrival of the Spaniards. And much as damage was done by the actual violence, by the uprooting, by the haciendas that were established, the slaves system that was created through encomienda and then through repartimiento and congregación, all these terms that are now synonymous with the first stage of the conquest.
And in English, they would be dividing the land into sections.
There were various means that the Spaniards used to guarantee a workforce for their haciendas. Mm. And they were not originated in the New World. They came from the Moorish Wars, from the Wars of Reconquest, the way they used some of the Moors that they had reconquered to work in the haciendas in Granada, for instance, after 1492. So many of the institutions that the current cycle of violence has used have their roots in the conquest, in the original conquest, and before that, in the reconquest. It's something about the character of all of this. The Spaniards never let anything go. All the institutions come back. And the Mayas are the same because they believe in a cyclical universe where everything recurs with variations. So these two have, in a way, conspired to create this idea of the cycles of the reconquest and the cycles of violence, the spirals of violence that come back with variations, usually with increased virulence. But the first cycle, what is now better understood is that the diseases that the Spaniards brought, what MacLeod called the shock troops of the conquest, were what really did all the damage. That for every Maya killed by the conquistadors, there were dozens killed by smallpox, chickenpox, influenza, and on, all of these diseases that did not exist in the New World. So the effects of that went on, because the diseases went on, the plagues came and went. But by the end of the 16th century, beginning of the 17th century, more than half of the extant population of Mayas in what is today Guatemala were killed. And there were 2.5 million at the beginning. And it took another 450 years for them to recover their numbers, 1950.
To get that population back.
To get the population back, and now they've doubled it. And curiously enough, paradoxically enough, it's this exploding population that is feeding into the current cycle of the reconquest as well, because it is creating all kinds of dislocations. One of them is overuse of lands, not enough lands, and then the refugee problems all come partly also from this burgeoning population.
It seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that one of the reasons that the Spanish and then forces within Guatemala are so attracted to controlling this country is that it's so resource rich. It's such a rich mm-hmm. land. Yeah. For people don't know Guatemala other than it's somewhere down there. It's in Latin America. Can you introduce us to this country physically?
Well, it's a small country. It's the size of Tennessee. It has a population now of between 9.5 and 10 million. And it's extremely diverse. It has two coasts, Atlantic and Pacific. And of course, it's the whole isthmus. It's part of this, what Neruda, the poet, the Chilean poet, called the sweet waste of America. Well, Guatemala is very much at the top of this cerebral column. Yes. The sweet waste of America. And in this sweet waste of America, there's been a lot of bitter, it's a bittersweet. I would call that a bittersweet waste of America myself. And partly because of the resources. The Spaniards, it was the gold. Guatemala, as it turned out, did not have the hoards of gold gathered by, for instance, Pizarro with in Peru, where there were enormous hoards, troves of gold that the Incas had gathered for themselves. And so when they realized that the gold was limited and they got all that there was available, they then turned to the land for the first time for cattle grazing, indigo, and started cultivating cacao. But this was considered very much secondary. You know, they wanted minerals, they wanted wealth, they wanted, this is what the conquistadors were about, and bring it back for the glory of Ferdinand.
And this first effort was what we would think of crassly as a hit-and-run effort. We'll go in, gather all the gold.
That was the idea, yeah. And then so the second wave that came are the ones that then became the hacendados, the ones that stayed and used the Mayas, those that survived the diseases and the conquest, as armies of peons for the haciendas. And that pattern more or less settled in during the whole colonial period. And so what you had is the criollos, the Spaniards that came, who remain today. Many of the largest landowners are still people that consider themselves criollos, even if they have Indian blood.
European orientation.
Very European in orientation. And they look back to Europe. Of course, they're now influenced by the U.S. as well in a number of ways. Certainly their VCRs and their TV. But out of the mistresses of these criollo conquistadors were Indian women. And of course, the famous Malinche, Doña Leonor, the with Alvarado's mistress, birthed the first Ladinos, the mixed breeds. And they are now in the majority of the non-Indian class, and they are the middle class of Guatemala. They are the military, except for maybe the highest echelon military. And they are starting to be the landowners as well. They're the mayors, they're the bureaucrats, and so they are in control of the Indian populations below them, so some of the most vicious aspects of the counterinsurgency campaign have been formulated by Ladinos who see Indians as expendable, as non-human in some way. This is part of the tradition that comes back to us from the conquest, and it's still there.
I kept seeing, not only in this book, but in your autobiography called Rights, R-I-T-E-S, Rights, what I thought to be a pecking order where the bottom of each order saw the next down as a non-person, a non-human. Is this historical? Did this come across?
Very much so, and it's still there. The criollos, of course, had disdain for the Ladinos, the peninsulares, they called them at the beginning, the Spaniards, the purebred Spaniards, had a kind of contempt even for their own children, born of the Mayan women.
Imperfect, not right. The offspring were imperfect.
Well,
results
more
of the
than
self.
Imperfect, they were tainted. You know, don't forget that all of the tainted blood thing that was going on in Spain at the time, you know, the Jewish and Moorish taint. Well, this is a Maya taint. It's the same mentality, less than pure Spaniard. And so, of course, they had this enormous sense of inferiority, Ladinos, to this day, which they took out on the Indians.
The next one.
So the Indians had to be less than themselves. But among the Indians, they picked out the sons of the former caciques, as they were called, the chieftains, and co-opted them, you know, the principales, they called them. And they used them to control the Indians below them. And in some cases, that's reflected today in what are called the military comisionados, those delegated by the army, or some case Indian mayors, who are then co-opted by the Ladinos, are given privileges and favors that they do not give to the community, and they Ladinicize them. Mm-hmm. They start wearing Ladino clothes. They don't wear their Indian clothes anymore. They don't speak their Indian language. They become bridges, so to speak. And that's why I have this chapter about the new Indian and the new Maya, the new Indian being the one who wants to work within the Ladino system and reap the benefits by integrating himself, and the new Maya who is bringing back Maya pride and may deal with the Ladinos, may even be a school teacher, but remains Maya at heart. That's a very interesting phenomenon going on now, the return of Maya pride, yeah, in a number of different ways.
And this, the return of Maya pride that you're talking about, the new Mayans, is a release valve to the pressure of all these
hierarchical pressures
and all these levels that are kept down in the Guatemalan community.
Absolutely.
That's right. Okay. We're talking today with Victor Pereira. His latest book is called The Unfinished Conquest, Guatemalan Tragedy. It is the third work of three, a trilogy he has called his life's work. It began with an autobiography that was actually the middle book. A look at his own life and how his life is reflected in the Guatemalan history, or that history is reflected in his life, I guess, more properly. And the center book, The Lords of Palenque, looking at the indigenous peoples of Guatemala.
Of southern Mexico.
Sorry. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. We're talking today with Victor Pereira. I want to turn to this unfinished conquest. It was in, you tell in your autobiography, writes of the first urban guerrillas, disaffected military people in the early 50s, the late 40s, who just said they had had enough of promises for a better world and a world steadily growing worse. But that really burst out in the 70s when the government slammed back hard. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I would say that the first of these guerrillas, of course, they could say they go back to the beginning, but it really came out of the downfall of Arbenz, the big CIA United Fruit operation with the conservative generals working together to overthrow a socialist president, Jacobo Arbenz. And interestingly enough, Che Guevara and Castro were involved in that process. They'd been in Guatemala. Especially Che Guevara. Che Guevara was very affected by the socialist regime, the socialist democratic regime of Arbenz, and before that, the spiritual socialist Arevalo. They call those 10 years, 44 to 54, the Guatemala Spring. Mm-hmm. Those of us still who look back on anything like a spring in the country of eternal spring, as it is called. And the way it was ended is what made it a nightmare. The way that the U.S. intervened because of Arbenz's agrarian reform program and because of the way it affected the United Fruit lands that Alan Dulles had been an attorney for. So that's really where all of what's happening today, the present cycle of conquest, really originates in 54 for me. The guerrillas do too.
I want to ask you specifically about what that way was, what happened, but people listening who don't know will be alerted to U.S. intervention and want to know why that was. Why did the U.S. go in? Was it this?
They went in for two reasons, for economic reasons, because the United Fruit lands had been taken over by the decree passed by Arbenz, the land reform decree, that took only the fallow lands, unused lands, which were extensive lands in the case of United Fruit, and parceled them out to the landless Indians. And United Fruit claimed that these fallow lands were actually in use, that mm-hmm. they should not have been taken, that they did not receive the compensation that they were worth. So there was that aspect of it, but then there was the Cold War aspect of it. Arbenz did have in his cabinet some members of the Communist Party. And that was all the excuse Alan Dulles needed. That's the only excuse that Eisenhower needed in the middle 50s.
This is evidence of creeping
communism.
They
have established an enclave in our backyard and so forth. So there was this double thing. And then they set up this tin pot general, Colonel Castillo Armas in Honduras to invade Guatemala and make it seem like an internal But it's more complicated than that. That's the bitter fruit version of it, so to speak. And there was a lot of internal dynamic as well. There was disaffection with Arbenz from the military, who had lost their own favorite, Arana, who had been killed mm-hmm. at the orders of Arevalo. That is not widely known. But in terms of the CIA operation, it's very important because this was considered the great CIA success. This is what fueled the attempt later on Allende in Chile. It led to intervention in Dominican Republic. It led to Panama, because this was the model that was going to be used by the CIA.
We can do the right thing in Latin America.
Yes, overthrow communism and at the same time reestablish a kind of democracy that has been. You know.
And a stable economy, right? As long as United Fruit is in charge.
Sure. Oh, the paramount reasons. Right. As Fortuny, the Communist Party member, said, I think they would have overthrown us even if we hadn't grown bananas. That's a very good summing up of the 54.
We're talking today with Victor Pereira. This is Conversations. After this began a time of well, no, I ask you, did the death squads begin then?
The death squads began essentially in response to the first guerrilla operations in the eastern part of the country.
These were thought of as extra military activities on your time off?
Well, you mean the death squadrons?
Yeah.
Well, yes, the first death squadrons were actually founded, it is widely believed, by the man Sandoval Alarcón, who inherited the Movement for National Liberation, which was the party founded by the colonel that the CIA had brought in. So it does go back to the CIA. And he was funded, Sandoval Alarcón, by the CIA, and his party was, for years. And he founded the Mano Blanca death squadrons, in part to offset the incursions of the rebel armed forces and the MR-13, the two guerrilla organizations that formed in the mid-60s, really, that really became very active then, and even established an urban foco, as it's called, in mm-hmm. Guatemala City. They introduced urban guerrilla warfare to our continent. They were first to do that. They were among the very first modern guerrillas, in fact, throughout the hemisphere. Colombia was the other place that had them. And once the landowners felt affected again, and they were in league with the military, you knew they were going to come down hard. And that pacification campaign of the late 60s, early 70s came down hard with the help of Green Berets, with the help of the U.S., to squash what they saw also again as another communist guerrilla. But the men who led that were former military officers, and with a burning sense of injustice, and they were manned by students, professionals. This was before the resurgence of the more sophisticated EGP, Guerrilla Army of the Poor, in the 70s, in the mid-70s, the one that worked directly with the Indians way up in the Ishkan province, which is in the Western Highlands. And they learned the language of the Ishil. They tried to integrate Ishil customs into the guerrilla. It was much more sophisticated. But they had one large failure, is that they suffered from a kind of premature success. They enlisted so many thousands of Ishil Indians who were burning with indignation at the way they were treated in the coffee fincas, that they didn't know what to do with them. They didn't have arms for them. And then when the army came down as hard as it did in the mid-70s, the guerrillas did not know how to protect them. And that was the second layer of failure, you might say, of the guerrilla movement. And it's a shame, because this one had, in a way, was more sophisticated, had clear intentions, but could not have forecast the viciousness of this Ladino class of military, the lengths they were willing to go to destroy 400 villages straight out, scorch and burn, and their other tactics, which included the civil patrols, the model villages, all borrowed again from institutions that were there in the first cycle mm-hmm. of conflict.
I want you to read, if you will.
Sure.
And you and I had thought we would read this section that I'm going to ask you to read towards the end of our time together, but perhaps it is better at the first. The reason you said to me that you wrote this book was because of an encounter with a woman in Glasgow who told you a story.
Sure.
Perhaps we could begin there.
Okay.
This is Victor Pereira with us today on Conversations. The book, again, is Unfinished Conquest. It is the third book in his trilogy. He calls his life work Telling the Story of Guatemala.
In October 1984, shortly before my return to Guatemala, I was invited on a speaking tour of Scotland by the Edinburgh office of Amnesty International. I was in Glasgow when a Catholic priest and two catechists with Guatemala's Justice and Peace Committee spoke at a local union hall. The youngest of the three Guatemalans touring northern European industrial cities was a Mayan woman who wore the patterned blue wraparound skirt and white blouse of Alta Verapaz province. After bowing from the waist and greeting each of the rugged miners and the others in her native Quechí Maya, Marina, as I call her, spoke in a clear, unfaltering Spanish of the massacre she had witnessed in her village outside Coban. In excruciating detail, she described the silent arrival of the platoon of soldiers, the efficient manner in which they rounded up the villagers in the square, separating the men from the women and children. After stabbing women and infants with their bayonets, they raped several younger women who pleaded in vain for mercy. Then the soldiers systematically tortured a dozen men they accused of being guerrilla collaborators and shot them point blank with their Galil rifles. Before departing, the soldiers set fire to every home in the village, including Marina's. The Scots audience listened to Marina's testimony in awed silence. Many among them were veterans of world wars and bitter mining strikes and had suffered economic hardship as well. None of them had heard anything like this before. After her presentation, I approached Marina and told her about the murder of my nursemaid, Chata, who had been a native of Coban, like herself. She gazed at me with her soft, dark eyes and touched my shoulder. As a Guatemalan, you know that I could not tell them the full truth of what is being done to our people, for fear no one would believe me. How could I tell them of watching a soldier bayonet my aunt in the stomach, rip out her four-month-old fetus and smash it against the house post? How could I speak to them of our children waking up screaming in the middle of the night, beyond comforting, and of our nightly prayers to God for justice in our land? And how should we seek justice? By arming ourselves? Fixing me with her clear gaze, unclouded by tears, Marina said, I have looked in the eyes of the soldier who raped and stabbed my aunt and killed her unborn child. And I know he is a child of the Mayas who live in Christ, as I am. Is it for me to pass judgment on him? Is it not for the soldier, driven by his superiors to commit these senseless atrocities, to seek forgiveness? What would happen to my soul if I had lifted a stone to kill the soldier? Would I not have become the same as he? Would not the violence instilled in him have won over me as well? These are the questions I ask myself. You know as well as I do how important it is that we tell the story of our people so that the army officers who ordered the massacres will not have the final say. Without another word, Marina shook my hand, bundled up in her borrowed down coat, and slipped out with her colleagues into the frigid northern night. These past years have led me to Marina's understanding that the violence visited on her village has in one way or another been visited on millions of other Guatemalans, myself included. This book tells a part of that story.
And this is the story that required you to write this book.
She was laying on hands on me to write the story.
Yeah.
And I knew I would have to.
That may have been a harder passage to listen to than you might have thought when you joined us in this edition of Conversations. It is the story of Guatemala in one woman's life and in one man's life, I think. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Victor Pereira with us. He is the author of The Last Lords of the Palenque, the Lacandon Mayas of the Mexican Rainforest, of Rights, a Guatemalan Boyhood, and of Unfinished Conquest, published in late 1993, subtitled The Guatemalan Tragedy. This book is a University of California at Berkeley publication, or University of California Press publication, I should rightly say. Victor Pereira is a lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley. He has been a lecturer instructor part-time since the early 70s in the University of California system, first at Santa Cruz and then at Berkeley. He is a full-time writer, has been a writer and an editor for all of his career. This man, born in Guatemala, raised in the United States, has been back and forth to Guatemala in the, am I right, 6 years it has taken
to... last 7 years now, yes.
Right.
I've been living there 6-7 months of the year.
To write this trilogy. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations on KUAC. You have referred to the Guatemalan War as the most underreported war going on today.
Certainly in our hemisphere.
Well, this is what I was thinking. If we talk to people from Tibet, they say theirs is. There is a quality of underreportage is it because the world's interests are not compelled by it, or tell me what you think.
I've been asking myself this again and again while writing the book. In fact, since I started writing on Guatemala in 1971, I've addled my brains trying to figure it out. And I've come up with two main explanations. One of them is that the 54 great CIA operation that was supposed to be a great triumph over communism didn't end up the way it was intended. It didn't bring in a flourishing democracy to Guatemala. It's only now that the concept of human rights is finally taking root. It created enormous dislocation. It did not work all that well in the other places they tried it either. And Americans, North Americans, don't really like to hear about their failures. They like to hear more about their successes. But I think the real reason is that Guatemala is just so much more complicated than either, for instance, Nicaragua or Salvador. I've written about four different communities that involve dozens of villages. And one of the things I found out is that no one community, no one village can tell the story of Guatemala. Is ever the microcosm for any other part of Guatemala. You have to go into the internal dynamic of each one.
This is Conversations on KUAC. And this is why. It is just too complicated to fix from the outside. Is that so?
It's too rich.
It's too rich.
I have fallen in love with this country again because of the richness. Part of the richness of it is that the resilience of these Maya communities that have been so badly hurt, an estimate of 120,000 dead during a 30-year period, 46,000 disappeared and unaccounted for, 1 million dislocated from their homes, 500,000 crossed the borders, don't come back. These are major figures for a country that at the time was about 8 million. Mm. So these kind of figures haven't sunk in to the North American conscience. And that's why I wrote that one passage to try to imagine what it would be like here if something like that would have happened. May I read that?
Yes, yeah. Please.
I think it's appropriate to read that, to try to bring it home to North Americans. This is an attempt for another analogy. One comes back always to the violence. It is as if, to try another analogy, the CIA and the FBI, in response to accelerated terrorist activity by black nationalists and a revived weatherman underground, were secretly to enlist and equip the white supremacist and Nazi factions as well as the Ku Klux Klan. They would fill out their ranks with green berets and mercenaries recruited by Soldier of Fortune magazine and set them loose, leaving 41,000 dead in 6 weeks. Among the casualties from both sides over a year-long period would be George Meany and Cesar Chavez, Robert Gates and James Baker, Max Frankel, Anthony Lewis, William Sapphire, Benjamin Bradley and Rupert Murdoch, Ralph Nader, John Kenneth Galbraith and Noam Chomsky, Mario Cuomo, Paul Nitze, Pat Buchanan, Oliver North, Dick Cheney, and a dozen big city mayors, including David Dinkins, Richard Daley, Frank Jordan, and Tom Bradley. Among the victims of contract killings would be Jesse Jackson, Ramsey Clark, former Congressman Stephen Solars and Jim Wright, as well as Jack Kemp and Newt Gingrich, Senators Mark Hatfield, Barbara Boxer, Jesse Helms, and Edward Kennedy, along with Jane Fonda and Ted Turner, and 3,000 to 4,000 other prominent citizens from the whole spectrum of U.S. public life. Also among the victims would be 10,000 students from Harvard, Berkeley, and a dozen other prestigious universities. Among the hundreds kidnapped by both sides and held for ransom or exchange, or simply to embarrass the government, would be Chief Justice Rehnquist, Vice President Al Gore, Archbishop O'Connor, Donald Trump, Frank Carlucci, Edwin Meese, and Ron Reagan Jr., David Rockefeller, Jack Valenti, Paul Laxalt, and Paul Getty Jr., James Brady, and the British, French, and German ambassadors. Stretch the analogy back to 1979, and the equivalent would be 500,000 U.S. citizens murdered, another 500,000 disappeared, and no less than 15 million forced into exile or held in secret detention centers where they would be subjected to systematic torture and mutilation. This is a rough idea of the scale of the war that has raged for over a quarter century in this picturesque Tennessee-sized republic of 9.5 million.
This brings it home.
Yes.
Yes, twice. I have wondered as I have listened to you and as I've read this and the other book how Guatemala can find its future with so many of its people, and it's not just intellectuals, it's not just leaders, people from all across all the spectrums gone.
Well, this is part of the richness that I was speaking of. I am optimistic by temperament, and this has tested my optimism to the full. But one of the things you discover is that a new generation of leaders in Guatemala can come up within 3 or 4 years of the killing of their predecessors. And so that's part of the resilience. Mayas come back very fast from natural and unnatural calamities. And one of the things that is very hopeful now is the way the Mayas are taking hold of their own lives in places like Santiago Atitlan, where thousands of Mayas marched on the garrison, and when they killed several of them, they brought the whole world to their village and they forced the garrison to leave. The first time in the history of Guatemala that had happened, and they've stayed out for 3 years because they now protect their community. Or the new leadership that is extremely careful of watching democratic procedure in all of their elections, they are going to replace, I think, the guerrilla. Even they may have had ties with them at the beginning. These four groups that I know of, called Conavigua, Surge, the Communities of Population and Resistance, and the Commission of Permanent Refugees, have all now named their own leaders. They've formed a coalition. And they are going to be the voices of opposition that the army and the government will have to deal with in the next round of talks.
You said that among other qualities of at least the Communities of Population in Resistance, which is such a remarkable title. Yes. One of the qualities is that they've lost their fear of the soldiers. This is a big step for
this
people
who are...
This
is, I would say, global throughout the highlands this has happened. Men, women, even children. It happened in Santiago Atitlan. There were children among those who marched. And some threshold got crossed during this 30-year civil war. And the loss of that fear has broken the pattern that we had for 500 years, where the army could use intimidation, torture, killing itself. Even torture wasn't enough anymore. Torture lasted for quite a long time because torture would intimidate not only the torturee, but the dozens of people around each victim. And now even that was not enough. The people were just so fed up. And other things, like the 500,000 that crossed the borders, many of them started sending back their little money orders with a few dollars that grew into more than a few dollars. And suddenly the Mayas, who were back in their villages, could use these few dollars to buy title to their land, finally, to buy their own transport. And this is part of this resilience as well, this kind of revival of Mayan pride. So it's on many fronts, and it's very exciting, I think. And no matter what happens, the army can no longer roll back the process anymore.
This question. You talk a lot about the army as the source of the violence. Are not the guerrillas also a source of violence against the people, mm-hmm. to the people who don't move right?
Yes, there have been killings of informers, army informers, as well as I know of only one village where the people turned against the guerrillas, and the guerrillas did carry out. Only one village may have killed as many as 100 that has been recorded. A man I respect, Robert Carmack, has estimated, he's an expert on Quiché, that the army killed 100 Mayan Indians for each one killed by the guerrilla. Oh. And I think that gives you an idea of the scale.
I had wondered at some point in my reading whether the Mayans, no matter, or I should say the Guatemalans, weren't caught between the violence of the guerrillas and the violence,
yes.
of the army.
That was the image for a long time, that of the Mayas caught in the crossfire. Mm-hmm. And however, the Mayas are now very much part of the process because they have formed their own leadership.
Yes.
So that no longer holds. They are now taking control of their own lives and also responsible for what will happen. Yeah. So it won't be a crossfire situation anymore.
Can we look at the life of children, especially in urban Guatemala? You either said or wrote, and I'm confused at this point about where it comes from in my mind, but that what's happening to Guatemala's urban children is part of an undeclared worldwide war against children. Can you talk to me about that and what that means to you?
Well, it means many things. I pointed out a figure that I think America's Watch may have come up with. It was a global organization that if a portion of the military budget of each of the third world countries where children are particularly dying in great numbers of malnutrition, if a small portion of the military budget of each of those countries were turned over to food and medicines, it would change the picture dramatically. These figures would decline. So the war is a war of neglect as well as a war of commission. And Guatemala and Brazil share the shame of being the two countries that actually have death squadrons that have specialized in killing children who they consider delinquents, petty criminals, etc.
That's the rationale.
Who live in the streets, yeah. And it is now proved that there were off-duty policemen, off-duty army people that were killing children in Guatemala just as they have been in Brazil. Mm-hmm. So there is that. There's the killing by neglect, killing by negligence, killing by commission, both. I consider that part of this war on children.
Is this, in your mind, venality or just stupidity, short-sightedness?
Well, a lot of it is third world mentality. A lot of it is willful. A lot of it is perverse. And part of the army, I have interviews in this book where a man who considers himself a college graduate, who is colonel, who is the comandante of Nebach at the time, a very crucial zone of conflict, actually spoke, and you could see he was speaking for other military officers as well, that it was the line, that children were essentially future guerrillas, that children had to be treated as future delinquents and future guerrillas, and that since the church and the families were not disciplining these children, it was going to be the role of the army to do it, because it would be easier to discipline them now before they became full-grown guerrillas. Mm-hmm. This was the mental attitude that this man had toward children.
So that that the importance is to keep his people at the top, no matter what the cost to humanity below him, so to speak.
Well, of course. That's true of every military. Self-perpetuation is the first priority.
With us today on Conversations, Victor Pereira. We're talking about his book, what is found inside his book, The Unfinished Conquest, The Guatemalan Tragedy. An upcoming book coming out in 1994 takes a look at his Jewish background and the history of his people as a Jew. It is called The Cross and the Pear Tree, A Sephardi Journey, and you can look for it from A Knopf in the United States in 1994. It'll be published by André Deutsch in England at that same time. Victor Pereira is an active contributor to periodicals, articles, stories, book reviews, and essays. You can find his works in The New Yorker, in Harper's, The Atlantic, The New York Review of Books, as well as many others, including Paris Review, The Nation, Partisan Review, and others. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversation. We're talking today about Guatemala. There is another, I don't know whether it's a declared war or an undeclared war, but against the natural resources of this country of Guatemala that has been going on perhaps since the time of the conquistadors, going in and taking out what you need without regard for ecological history or future. Where do you assess your country's ecological state at this point?
I think that it is unfortunate that the term of environmentalism, that the language of ecology, biosphere, is still a language held only by a relatively small elite in Guatemala, and a few of the agrarian leaders in several communities in Petén, Sierra de las Minas, who are being indoctrinated into an environmental movement. The concept of human rights is taking root a lot sooner, but the self-preservation of the environment, the issue of stopping the runaway logging in the Petén, of stopping the loggers that have started up now in the Oriente province, has not become a burning issue the way human rights has. And for that reason, I think the army and the loggers and the contrabandists from Mexico and the Japanese who buy the contraband lumber, this conspiracy, this huge mafia, will go on having its way for at least 3 or 4 years, and that will do away with most of the hardwoods of the Petén and also in other parts of Guatemala that have not yet been encroached upon in that way. So my optimism is particularly sorely tried on the environmental issues. There are other problems, but the one of deforestation of a country whose very roots, Cuatemalan in Nahuatl, meant land of many trees, It's too painful. It's a very painful paradox.
Do you think that the country's unwillingness to look at what those who are ripping out of Guatemala are doing is because there are so many other compelling problems, or?
Yes, hunger is so much more compelling than environmentalism. And it is still abstract to them because they've been brought up to believe that resources in Guatemala were inextinguishable, that there was so much, that this is what they had. They all need leña, they all need their firewood, and they have to go on believing, even if they have to go miles and miles to get them, that there will always be firewood, that you don't have to reseed a field, a forest, so you will have firewood in the future. That kind of vision is slow to take hold, and it is finally taking hold. I hope it comes in time.
There are outside groups from the United States and elsewhere who want to impact the rainforests, whether they are in Guatemala or elsewhere, favorably. Are these groups having an effect, or are they troublesome to Guatemala?
You mean the environmental groups?
Yeah.
Yes, they're beginning to. Nature Conservancy is working. Conservation International is working there. They are beginning to have an impact by trying to convince the people who live in Petén that a standing forest will essentially feed them better in the long run than cutting down the forest. But again, this is a fairly sophisticated concept, that you drop some trees and leave others, that you replant a tree and then take care of it because it won't grow by itself, for each one, or 10 trees for each one you log. This takes time. This takes time. And the loggers are very cynical on the whole. They're people in for the short run. They're in for the quick buck. And they're not the ones that are going to bring that consciousness. The young people themselves will have to do it. And that's where it will have to take root.
I suppose the question then is, will it take root?
Yes, eventually. But I don't know how much will be left when it does. It's not just Guatemala's problem. We're talking of all of Central America. I've gone through the reserves and the rest of Central America, and it's hard for different reasons in each of those countries. It's hard in Brazil. Brazil is the one we know about. Mm-hmm. We know about the eco-martyrs like Chico Mendes. Well, Guatemala has its own now, too. It has Mario Dadi. It has a number of others who have now future eco-martyrs who are putting their lives on the line, because loggers go out and kill people who get in their way.
This is what I was going to ask about. People who stand to defend the forests can, fall like the trees do.
Absolutely. Yes.
You said human rights were, as a concept, is taking hold in Guatemala, and that it's not a Mayan tradition to defend human rights. You have
per se.
You have favored Jimmy Carter and the United States Constitution.
I give him a lot of credit, and Patricia Darien specifically, who brought that idea to Latin America. And he was vilified and hated so much by the private sector, by the army for it. He was called Jimmy Castro at the time, that you knew he was on to something. And I think it took a while. I mean, it took all the Reagan years, you know, before it actually took root. So it's been there since the 70s, and it's now that it's taking root. Well, the environmental language has only been there since, let's say, the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I give Carter credit because we all are so aware of the horrible mistakes that have been made, the interventions. It's good to have one positive story come from a U.S. Example.
What signs do you see inside Guatemala that this concept of human rights might affect some part of the transformation?
Into the environmental as well? You mean that it might become part of that? The sovereignty of the trees, as somebody said, as well as the sovereignty of the people?
Well, I had not been thinking about that, but yes.
That's an idea that I've tried to push through, that sovereignty, which is such a word for the nationalists, for the third worlders, you know, the sovereignty that we must protect against the superpowers, et cetera, should apply as well to the whales and to the jaguars and to the trees, that they have their own sovereignty. And that may be one way to bring this concept through, you know, that they are precious lives and have their own sovereignty. It's a good word. Yeah, I do feel that there is a transformation afoot. The transformation has to do with people power, with Maya power, with dollar power that they are bringing back. With this raised state of consciousness, the sense that their backs were against the wall. And however, that also creates dislocations. This overpopulation problem is a huge problem. Mm-hmm. So each of my reasons for optimism has a caveat attached to it.
Balanced
and each of my caveats may have a positive possibility as well.
We need to look at this thought of this problem of overpopulation. People from the outside will say if the Guatemalans would only get their act together and not create so many babies, they wouldn't have the hunger which causes the crowding, the numbers of people that causes the crowding, that causes the hunger, that causes the deforestation. Talk to me about how...
Who are we to say that? I mean, who are we to have the authority to say that, even if we're right, when Pope John Paul II is saying the very opposite, is saying that people who say this are the evil, that we must not have family planning, and this creates a lot of confusion. Guatemala is still nominally a Catholic country. Two-thirds of Guatemalans are Catholic. So if one world leader, the spiritual leader, is telling them to go on having babies, mm-hmm. Which they believe anyway, the Maya idea is that children are their only true resource, and they know they're going to lose a lot of them before the age of five. Guatemala has the highest infant mortality rate in the Western Hemisphere, along with Haiti. So that's very hard to change as well. And our examples are very muddled because they're contradictory. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem.
Tell me how you see Guatemala City as a result of both dispossession and increased population.
Well, I grew up in Guatemala City, and I can't live there anymore because of the urban problems. Overpopulation is only part of it. A lot of it has to do with the technology that has come in. The diesel fumes alone, there's no control of exhaust fumes in Guatemala. That's one of the first things you realize when you're there. There's a kind of anarchic growth that has to do a lot with the dislocated Mayas coming in from the communities that have been destroyed or from overuse, over-abused lands, and pouring into Guatemala. That's why the basurero, the dump, was such an image of that. Thousands of people working, recycling plastics and cardboard that come down from the first world.
Well, and people won't understand that these are people living in the dump, making their lives in
it. A lot of them live there, and even more of them come for the day. But it's a Dantesque kind of world. You have to go see it to really believe the many sort of circles of hell you can encounter in that place, and yet people survive there, especially the women. And that's part of the resilience that astounds me about Guatemala.
Let's pause for, there's a short reading from The Life in the Basurera that affected me.
The thousands of scavengers who wrest the bare subsistence from the basurero live the shadow lives of the rich whose scraps they collect, consume, or recycle. A broken umbrella becomes an excuse for a sensuous stroll down a dimly remembered boulevard. Discarded LPs with yesterday's hit tunes are replayed on imaginary stereos. A throwaway piece of costume jewelry is worn for a night and then sold to feed a family for a week. Magnets are sold to Salvadorans as magic charms that attract good fortune. A twisted brass trumpet played deftly by a 12-year-old sets off a New Orleans Mardi Gras stomp. Jazz, Hollywood, baseball, half-eaten Big Macs in plastic containers, TV reruns in shop windows are most of what they know of gringo culture, refracted through the glittering shards of a thousand spent and shattered dreams.
This is actually an almost romantic picture of a very, very hard life.
Yeah. It's to contrast it a little bit with the more, I also compare it to the guts of Benares, of India, the darker images, that there is, this is to bring out more of the resilience, and also the effect of U.S. culture. These are the discards of first world culture that they are living with. And one of the big points I make here is that we are creating a new underclass that will help recycle our waste so that the first world won't drown all of us in their waste. Garbage is a big, big item.
Big business.
And yes, big business. And it's going to be a big factor in our lives to come, both in the first and the third world.
You describe in many different ways a division between the genders in terms of strength. I see images of women who survive and men who fall behind.
Yeah.
Over and over and over. Why is this so?
Well, in the Basurero is particularly dramatic because there you really do see, I say that the men drift through the lives of the women of the Basurero like pale spirits who leave nothing behind but their seed.
Yes.
Because they die so quickly. And I've come to the conclusion the reason is because men live in the garbage and they die by the garbage, the diseases and so forth. And the women have this amazing ability to go through the garbage and root themselves in the soil underneath. And that's the only way I can explain the strength that they seem to draw from being in this hellish, Dantesque place.
Why? Yeah. Do you have a sense?
Well, Guatemalan women are particularly bound to the earth. Many of them have been brought up working alongside their fathers, cultivating both Indian and non-Indian. They've worked in the coast. And so they're naturally part of the of the earth. And then there are other reasons that are less easy to explain. Mm-hmm. That's just it's just part of the feminine nature that is perhaps more resilient.
This last question is a departure from our last subject, but relates to a couple before it. You said to a young man who asked you in a class situation, who said, maybe we ought to, Americans, North Americans, people of the United States, stay out of places like Guatemala, leave them alone to figure out their own problems. Your response was, the days of non-intervention are over.
That's right.
Why?
Because of the effect we had on the country in 1954. In a strange kind of way, I think that we made Guatemala our ward, that we created so much havoc out of that 54 intervention and prevented an internal social movement from actually taking root, that we are responsible for the bitter fruits of that intervention. And now we have to, it's not that we have to correct it, it is now, the world has grown a lot closer, the economies are all tied together, there's no separation anymore. And it does require the example of the U.S. Constitution, even when this country isn't the best one to fulfill the terms of the Constitution, to help bring about democracy in Guatemala. The time has come now for positive intervention of that kind. The economies are all interdependent now, far more than they were 30 years ago. So there's no question of non-intervention economically either. So these issues, yes, are now with us. We have to all work together.
What must this nation do for that nation?
Well, apart from the Economically, I think it's more complicated. The multinationals have been a factor in Guatemala for a great deal. There are programs to help Indian communities start up. There's Peace Corps. There are a number of other. But I think more than anything, it's the example of the human rights and perhaps an environmental example that is needed right now.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you the other side of this? What must we not do?
Not do is military intervention, not beef up their militaries to keep out communism. There is no communism to keep out anymore. And we mustn't create new bugbears. For instance, I'm sometimes afraid that the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, will now go in under the excuse of getting rid of cocaine traffickers and intervene militarily or politically through that kind of guise. So non-intervention in any military sense of the word, that's the thing.
And do you think that we are any more enlightened about people who live to the south of us than we were in 1954?
By fits and starts. I think there was some enlightenment on the part of Roosevelt. I think Kennedy began on a good path, got sidelined by his death, and then a great society got sidelined by the Vietnam War. And I think Clinton may have good intentions. I think Carter was the clearest one in terms of the clarity of the human rights, was the clearest positive example. I'm waiting to see. I'm withholding judgment on Clinton. I'm not sure yet.
Mm-hmm. If not help, then perhaps at least not damage is your hope, huh?
Well, yes, that's a more stoical kind of response, yes.
And from within Guatemala, is your greatest hope with the Mayan people rather
yes,
than?
Yes, by far. If I had to place a bet, I would bet on the Mayans every time.
In part because they have the most to gain?
Because they are the most resilient, because they've been around, because they have the clearest vision.
Thank you, Victor Pereira. I recommend to you this book, The Unfinished Conquest, The Guatemalan Tragedy by Victor Pereira. It is a fascinating read about a country of which this country knows too little. Victor Pereira with us on Conversations today. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you join us again next week. And thank you very much for spending time.
Thanks. It was really more like a visit.